Well, in essence, as far as we can tell so far, it developed in the Society Islands in Tahiti. And as far as we can tell, Tahitians seem to have introduced some reduced form of their language in contact with Europeans. They made fun of Europeans about not being able to speak Tahitian. And so that happened already during Cook's time. So this was in the late 18th century. The Europeans then seemed to use this form of reduced Polynesian also with the Maori in New Zealand. And there's some indication that they brought some form of it to the Hawaiian Islands, although the historical evidence is not conclusive. Some people might challenge me on that. Later on, the historical documentation is solid. There's a Hawaiian variety emerging. And in essence, these varieties, the Tahitian, the Maori, and the Hawaiian variety, they were so close to each other, grammatically speaking, lexically speaking, in terms of their structure and in terms of their sounds, that people could understand each other. So you have actually even Europeans who grew up in the Society Islands coming to the Hawaiian Islands using their variety with Hawaiians, and apparently they had little or no difficulty on using their reduced form of Tahitians with Hawaiians. This is what I'm talking about. This is what this book is all about. By the time the first Europeans arrived in the Hawaiian Islands, they already had a reduced form of Polynesian.
Got it. Great.
And this was used for about 100 years until the mid-19th century and into the second half of the 19th century. And then eventually it yielded to Pidgin English. But Pidgin English actually has a much shorter history than we realize, at least in Tahiti, it seemed to have survived well into the 20th century. This is in essence a reduced form of Hawaiian with few or no endings, no inflections, no particles. Or few particles, grammatical particles. So it's in essence just verbs and nouns and pronouns, perhaps single grammatical particles, but very few at best. But it was Polynesian, thoroughly Polynesian, not European. There were only very few European words, perhaps no more than 10. The vocabulary was essentially Polynesian. The grammar was essentially Polynesian, although the word order was subject, verb, object, rather than verb, subject, object, as we know from Polynesian languages. It is an academic book, and so one has to have some background in linguistics, but it's not overly formal. In other words, it doesn't require a great deal of technical skills or theoretical analysis. I've deliberately tried to make it keep it understandable for somebody who has an academic background. in social sciences other than linguistics. So I'd like for also archaeologists and cultural anthropologists, historians to be able to read it. There's a wonderful historical example which many historians have interpreted to be Hawaiian proper, but it's not Hawaiian proper. It is really the Polynesian pidgin. Well, I've also used it on the website that the university just put up.
Their news, yeah.
So, for instance, this, by the way, is also historically interesting from another perspective. It was recorded by a fur trader, British fur trader, in 1789. So this is in the late 18th century. When Great Britain and Spain were about to, or almost to enter war over the Nootka, as part of the Nootka controversy, because they, in essence, were almost to enter war over British Columbia, what is British Columbia today. Anyway, there's this wonderful example, for instance, Oi noho noho hale teni o tini noni o kapitan. So this, in essence, says you live or reside at the house of the chief, who is small, or the captain. So Oi, you noho noho, live or reside, hale, house, Tene o tini noni, small chief. This is actually Tahitian, not Hawaiian. O kapitan, or kapitan, captain. And here we have a Spanish loan word, which is very unusual. So, this is a wonderful example. It also illustrates that the primary context of the pidgin at the time was not only European explorations, but the North American fur trade, which extended also into the Pacific from northwestern North America to China, in which the Hawaiian Islands were a major way station between northwestern North America and China. Many local historians seem to have forgotten. This was a major economic endeavor at the time, leading such major companies as the Hudson's Bay Company to have a store in downtown Honolulu, for instance. It gives a much richer sense of colonial history. In other words, it gives a sense of a different sense of what happened at the time, and I think it also gives a different perspective of who was really still in power at the time. And my argument would be that the sociolinguistics here reflect the social and political arrangements fairly closely. In other words, I'm arguing in the end that through at least the early 19th century or the mid 19th century, Hawaiians and other Polynesians still had major influence in local affairs as is indicated by the sociolinguistic arrangements, and this gives quite a different perspective from what conventional ideas about language use would suggest. Conventional ideas suggest, well, Europeans came into the Pacific, everybody started speaking some kind of pidgin English or some version of French, and that's it. Well, that did not happen. Actually, any elaborate documentation of pidgin English did not appear until the 1860s or so. That's fairly late. That's about 100 years after Cook's arrival in the Pacific. So that's quite different from what we used to think even a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And so in essence, I think the point I'm trying to make here is that historical sociolinguistics here can provide a different angle of what happened, and without denying, of course, what ultimately happened with the overthrow of those who were in power and owned the land.